Hi, and welcome to Filmmakers Compass Podcast, a show where we talk about movies and, well, more movies. I'm D-Man, joined by CP. And CP, this week we have a very special episode in store for everybody because we did something very special. So we're going to dive into that in a minute. But first of all, how are you doing? You're smiling, so I'm assuming you're doing well.
Well, I'm just excited because I know how excited you are. I feel like this is the episode that you wanted to have since we started this podcast.
We've mentioned it in previous episodes that we are doing something special, and if anybody's been following us on social media, then you probably already know exactly what we're talking about.
And let me just apologize, because if you follow the FCP Instagram, I'm the jackass that actually posted 75 updates over the weekend. It's actually not D-Man, it's all me.
Well, for any of our listeners that actually don't follow us on social media, we're not holding off the surprise on this episode until after shoutouts, because many of the shoutouts came from you guys commenting on what we posted. And that surprise is that we actually got together in person and attended a 24-hour Star Wars marathon of the Skywalker saga, which includes all 9 films. So if you do the quick math on that, 9 times 2 for 2-hour films is 18 hours plus 20 to 30 minute breaks in between each movie, get you about to almost exactly 24 hours. So pretty remarkable. And CP, as we mentioned, we were really, really excited for this weekend.
Dude, you saying it, I still can't believe we actually did it.
I mean, I think a lot of people were in disbelief that they're like, yeah, but like 24 hours, like you go see like the prequel trilogy, then you go home, then you go back tomorrow. I was like, no, it's like 24 hours straight. And we're going to get into all those details and what made this event so special. But we wanted to make sure that everybody has the context for all of our shout outs that we're going to do right here at the top. So first up, CP, you can join me in this shout out. I want to give a huge shout out to Regal at the Irvine Spectrum for hosting this event and allowing us the opportunity to watch all the Skywalker Saga Star Wars movies on the big screen. I mean, it was incredible.
Yeah, they were fantastic. D-Man, you know I'm a big AMC guy. I love my A-list, love my stubs. But Regal, thank you for really rolling out the red carpet and just, it was a fantastic time. You guys were awesome.
Knocked it out of the park. There's lots of details and about the experience, again, that we'll talk about once we get into the actual meat of this show. But on that note as well, and hopefully we'll be able to get some more details from her directly, just wanted to give a huge shout out to my wife, Steph, for being part of our trio for the event.
Yes.
It was fantastic, and I think the three of us had such a blast that it's a memory I won't forget. And I know with Steph, you know, I know she's probably a bigger Star Wars fan today than she ever was, partially due to my love for that franchise. And it was just so much fun to get to share the whole experience with you guys. And I loved it. So thank you. Next up, I have a shout out from Crystal on Instagram who said, tell me this guy is related to you because you all look so much alike. Now she is texting me directly about you. So do you think we look alike?
No way. That's hilarious.
Yeah, I think I posted that photo of you and I just like in the theater seats and she's like, that's your brother, right?
I'm
like,
no, but I did. We did shoot a movie in undergrad and I remember one of the guys in it, my friend Scott, afterwards, he's like, is that like your brother or something? Referring to you. And I was like, no, that other guy is actually my brother. I was like, that's just my best friend. So hilarious.
Yeah, I guess that's a thing. So listeners, let us know. Big shout out to David, who said, how was it? Referencing our experience at the theaters. We are going to dive into that on this episode, David. So I hope you're listening. And he also mentioned that, he wants to do another marathon. So even if we can't see him all in the theaters, David, I'm always down for a Star Wars marathon. So
yeah, D-Man always is.
Next up, I got to give a shout out to Antonio, Anthony Torres. Really appreciate you, man. I don't know how you were awake as well, but CP, he was texting me throughout the night of the marathon at like 2:30 in the morning. He's like, what movie are you on? I'm like, it's Revenge of the Sith. Then at like 4, he's like, are you guys watching Empire yet? I'm like, no, it's A New Hope. And I, you know, I'm like, it just ended. So Anthony, it was fun. You kept me on my toes and kept me honest. I was awake. So we'll get into that as well. Shout out to Rudy, who I actually, CP, I don't know how I made it to this, but I ended up going to the LA County Fair the next day.
Dude, I'm shocked you did.
Yeah, and I got to see all of our family, and Rudy and I had a fairly in-depth conversation about the just the theater experience and what I really liked about it. And I always appreciate, movie conversations, but I had a lot of fun talking about that with you, Rudy. Next up, shout out to Brandon, who he saw that I was attending the marathon, and he actually shared a photo of himself with me wearing a Star Wars slash Ohio State, the Ohio State University shirt. So I know you probably hate that CP, that Star Wars is tied in with OSU, but
I
what are your
actually do.
thoughts?
I actually do.
Yeah, it was a original trilogy Star Wars shirt, R2 and 3PO, but it looked pretty dope. And I know he's sporting it mainly because of the Ohio State.
Yeah, I
But
don't think he cares about Star Wars. I just think he cares
Brandon,
about.
I do love to see you in Star Wars gear, so
Now,
keep it
did he
up.
go to Ohio State or Ohio University? I don't remember.
No, he did never attended Ohio State, but he did live in Columbus, and that was a big part of his community. He's also a huge OSU football
Or
fan,
did he go
so
to Miami of Ohio?
he went to Miami.
Of Ohio.
Miami.
He doesn't even
Yeah.
listen to this podcast. I don't know why I'm trying to harass him.
Next up on our shoutouts is Gary Osberg, who said, took the boy to see Phantom Menace today in the theater. So good. And yeah, he liked it. Longest live action he's seen in the theater. So, oh, it's so amazing. There's new Star Wars fans even to this day.
Gary, thank you for raising the kids right. We appreciate this. We need more
Yes, and
parents like you.
I don't know if I mean, because he's referencing seeing it in the theater, if he's either seen the movie before or has seen other Star Wars movies at home on like Disney Plus or something. But if this was truly the first Star Wars movie that he saw and it's in the theaters and episode one, wow,
Mazel
that is
tov.
awesome. Yeah, that's incredible. So big shout out to Ivor, who liked all of our photos. And he also said, just trying to make all of us common folks jealous. And CP will make a special trip for this. Hermit comes out of his San Diego cave. What are your thoughts, CP?
Hey man, to be fair, and just so everybody knows, D-Man and I were actually considering seeing this separately. But it turns out they only did 13 of these screenings around the country. So Irvine was in the middle of both of us.
Yeah, it actually worked out fantastic. It's actually really close to in the middle. It's a little out of the way for both of us. It's not, on the way for me to go to you, and it's not on the way for you coming this way either, but it's like a triangle point.
Yeah,
Like it's
it's.
about the same distance if we each take a different path.
Yeah.
So it kind of works out. But yeah, it was great. And we'll kind of talk about that too, about the what made this event a little bit more special, and it's pretty neat. So thanks, man. Appreciate everybody that liked our photos. But Ivor, I didn't count, but I think you liked most of them. So I'm gonna say that you liked every single one. So thank you. Vaughn jumped in on one of my posts. He saw that I shared, and he actually said, "Saw OG Star Wars in '77."
Oh, wow.
Which is
Jealous.
incredible. I'm so jealous, Vaughn. And that's because I wasn't alive. I didn't have the privilege of getting to watch, Empire Strikes Back when it first dropped, getting to see the magic of original Star Wars, which he's right. At that time, it wasn't even called A New Hope. It was just Star Wars. And getting to see that when, I mean, now Star Wars is referenced so often as an inspirational film for so many current filmmakers. I can only imagine how magical it must have been to be in that audience. So that is pretty sweet. Boone jumped in. Shout out to Boone, who said, "Get hyped for The Acolyte." And we're going to talk about that as well. CP, jump into a little bit about, we got an exclusive look at a trailer that dropped, I think, a day or two after our experience, which was pretty cool. Sean, I actually exclaimed in our chat. I said, "I finished the Lucas saga." And now Sean chimed in and said, "Now time for the bad ones." And that's a reference to Disney's sequel trilogy, which again, I did stay and watched all nine movies. So I do have thoughts. And Sean, we'll get to that as well.
I would just like to second Sean's sentiments. You are correct, good sir.
Matt said that 24 hours in a movie theater must be awful. So Matt Hellison, I would expect nothing less from you, but
Pretty
appreciate
sure
your
he
comment.
hates Star Wars too.
Thanks for engaging with me though, Hellison, on it. I'm sure he knows deep down how special it is for me, and he just had to tell me that it must be awful. So thank you. And then finally, I had a couple birthday shout outs. So I wanted to give a birthday shout out to Liz, who we celebrated at the LA County Fair, Sue, who was at the river, and I hope you had a great time. And then KG, Karen Gaston. Hope you guys all had fantastic birthdays.
Yay.
So,
happy
and
birthday,
if I missed
everyone.
Anybody, I apologize. Just let me know. And, you know, there's always another episode and more shout outs next week. So hope everybody had a great birthday. And then finally, CP, a happy May the 4th be with you. I hope everybody had a fantastic Star Wars day. And I appreciate all of you, all of those of you who texted me directly about it. I did get a few, Bob, Anthony Morales, my Aunt Teresa, and everybody. I got a bunch of messages. I really appreciate you guys. You know, this year's Star Wars Day, May the 4th, was one for the books. I will not forget it. So, CP, I'm going to throw it over to you. Do you have any shout outs before we move on? That was a lot.
No, I think you got everyone that we, you know, needed to give a shout out to.
All right. Well, on that note, let's go ahead and throw it over to you for our box office breakdown.
Cool. This is our box office breakdown, everyone, and we will keep this very, very quick. So, couple new movies in the top. The number three film in the U.S. box office is Challengers, which came out last weekend. It has now dropped from the number one spot to the number three spot. It's made about $30 million total, so way to go, Zendaya. Number
two.
I
haven't seen it yet, although I'm not sure how I feel about going to watch like a threesome in a movie theater with other people. It's kind of weird, I guess.
Well, I don't know what to tell you either. I didn't know that there was one until you were telling me it the other day online, and I was like, not the vibe I was getting. I thought it was just about tennis.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Number two, D-Man, you are going to love to hear this. Star Wars The Phantom Menace, episode
No
one.
Way. That's amazing. Now, for anybody that doesn't know, it is the 25th anniversary. This released in May 1999, and how exciting. It's
now
back
you,
in the
you can't all go watch the nine movies like we did, but you could, and I believe still can, go see episode one, and it made over $8 million in
that
the box office.
That is insane. That's awesome. Star Wars is back, baby.
Congratulations, Disney. Thank you for putting that out for us. And number one in the box office is Universal's The Fall Guy, which made almost $30 million.
I had a feeling that was going to be number one. It's on my list. I do want to go see that. I think I will this week. I heard good things. I heard people so far have enjoyed it.
Now, when we will look at the worldwide box office, things really haven't changed. Kung Fu Panda, number three. Godzilla Kong, The New Empire, number two, which has made, you know, quite a bit. Almost 550 million, or 550 million worldwide. And then number one, still Matt Hilson's favorite movie, Dune Part Two, which is over $700 million. The guess now is that it's going to top $715 million. So Dune, tip of the cap, keep it up.
Nice. Well, it's definitely really cool to see something like The Phantom Menace get a re-release and do so well, because I'm sure there is a sort of passing of the torch, right? Like, let me share The Phantom Menace with like my kids who didn't have the chance to see it in the theaters. You know, it's one of those great shared experience moments. Like, I want to take them and experience it with them. But also, I mean, it's just really cool to see the fans coming out and really enjoying this film. I saw a lot of, you know, reaction videos and commentary videos on my social feed that people were going to see The Phantom Menace, which is very cool. I love that. Yeah, a big, just in general, like for the event that we attended and for re-releasing Star Wars The Phantom Menace in theaters again, you know, like you said, a big tip of the cap, a big shout out to Disney for taking the opportunity to actually do this, because we haven't had Star Wars in the theaters for a few years now. The last movie, I believe, was Rise of Skywalker back in like 2019. Mm-hmm. So we haven't had Star Wars on the big screen, but the fact that they're willing to go back to the OG Star Wars and say like, hey, we love this too. Even though it's not Disney Star Wars, we still want to celebrate these milestones and share these films with everybody because we love them. So appreciate it, Disney. Thank you. All right. Well, CP, let's go ahead and sort of dive into our experience here, talking a little bit about a 24-hour Star Wars marathon. So tell us just a little bit about what a 24-hour movie marathon at a theater is actually like. Well, I mean,
yeah, that's a good point. And for our listeners, D-Man and I actually had a big conversation where we were actually kind of trying to strategize this. So the first thing you need to know is the first movie in the marathon kicked off Friday night at 8 p.m. So most of this marathon was actually during the night hours.
Yeah,
it's
middle
not
of the
like
night.
They started it at 10 a.m. and we went through, you know, the following evening. So that was a big shift.
Yeah.
The other thing is we just weren't really sure what we were going to be in for. Was the theater going to even be having concessions open late and things like that? So, you know, were they going to have a break between movies? We didn't know any of these things. So we kind of put our heads together and formed some contingency plans based on what was going to happen. And I got to say, Regal took care of us. They took care of everything. And that was really fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I brought a lot of stuff. I packed, like, you know, almost like a care package. I packed it with Red Bulls, some other energy drinks, Gatorades, water. But, you know, I wasn't 100% clear on whether or not I would actually be able to bring these things into the theater.
Yeah.
And, you know, or if, like, I would have to go out to my car and, like, chug one, you know,
yeah,
really quick.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if chugging Red Bull's great for your heart, but I was willing to do it. And then I also brought a few things like my lightsabers. I brought my droid up here. You know, I was definitely, you know, sort of wearing Star Wars gear, prepared for the movie marathon, but a little unsure about how that actually works. And I think one of the things that really stood out was in this case, and I can't speak to all the other 12 experiences that happened throughout the country, but Regal really took care of us and made this event special.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, as you mentioned, they were one of the fortunate 13 groups of people. I don't know if it was limited to 13 or they were the only ones that were willing to actually do the full 24 hour and like host that. I'm not sure what the limit was or what that agreement was, but there were only two showings in California, one in Hollywood and one at the Irvine Spectrum. That was it. All of California as a state.
That's crazy.
When we started the marathon, they actually came in and did an introduction, sort of talked about what the experience will be like. And they even asked the crowd, like, how far are some of the people who, you know, how far have people traveled? And there were people from out of state, from up in Northern California that all came down to experience this marathon. So that was pretty cool. As far as the theater goes, you know, there were things that they did to really take care of everyone. Like right out of the gate, everybody got a wristband. And that wristband allowed you to come and go from the theater. And all the employees knew that people with these wristbands were part of this marathon. And it let us sort of get in with in and out without having to, you know, have the manager come over and do all of that. It just made things flow really smooth. So that was nice that you were able to sort of step outside. I mean, obviously, we don't smoke, but if people wanted to take a smoke break, if you wanted to go take a nap in your car, if you had something at your car, which we did, I had Red Bulls. I was like, guys, I'm going to go grab Red Bulls. Like, I need a energy boost right now.
Yeah. To that note, the theater said, hey, we understand that you're here for 24 hours. Food and beverage is limited. So if you guys want to have food delivered, if you want to get something and bring it in, we're not going to give you a bad time. And I thought that was really cool.
Yeah. Like, I know Steph and I, after we got to the Disney sequel trilogy, we went and got Panda Express and we came back and ate it during Force Awakens. You know, I think when we were in one of the theaters, somebody had pizza delivered, you know, in the middle of the night. And like, they were just open to the experience. They were like, they came in and one of the main guys, the manager for Regal, actually said that, you know, he's like, listen, we want you guys to have a great experience at the end of the day. And if that means you're not eating our food, then we don't really care about that. Like, we want you to have a great time. And yeah, I loved it. I thought that was great. And so to that end, go ahead, CP.
No. They also hooked us up with, they said, hey, your ticket includes a large popcorn and a large soda, and we're going to be running concessions the whole time. So eat and drink to your heart's content. We got you there, which was also cool.
Yeah, they literally, which I didn't expect anything like that. They were like, free popcorn and soda. And they were like, with the wristband, you get free refills for 24 hours. Yeah. They're like, you get to enjoy that. The concessions are open. They actually had a couple different little restaurants because the Irvine Spectrum Regal Theater is actually really nice.
Oh yeah, it's incredible.
It looks like a premier sort of theater experience. It was not a stock experience where I think, over here, like we have two AMCs that we often go to either or. And I mean, they're pretty similar overall. Like, same sort of layout, same feel. And even though the actual, experience might be slightly tweaked, you're like, no, I know I'm at an AMC. But this Regal, I've been to our Regal out here too in West Covina, and it is not like that.
No, this is really nice. They also did a lot of things that I thought were cool for fans. They brought in some cosplayers to take photos and kick off the night. They played trivia and were giving away prizes to everyone.
Yeah, they actually had a special commemorative anniversary edition poster that everybody who had a wristband got when they finally decided to leave the marathon, and that was at whatever time you wanted. And it's a really dope poster. And CP, something to take note of with that poster is it actually says on there Skywalker Saga Marathon for this event. So these are not generic posters
No.
that they're just giving out to the people. This was like it's literally inked on the thing. This poster only went to the people who attended this marathon. So I don't know how many are out there. 13 showings across the country, but if everybody at these showings got one of these posters, there's probably only like 1,500 of them. This is a true collectible poster.
Yeah,
And I don't
no,
know
it
about
was
you.
awesome.
I mean, Steph and I are already talking about going and getting a frame,
Yeah, I
hanging
was
ours
thinking the
up,
same thing, man.
because it's a really dope poster. So that was pretty cool. I know you actually shared it on our Filmmakers Compass social media. So if anybody had a chance to check that out, let us know with you what you think. But it is a 25th anniversary, The Phantom Menace commemorative poster. So it was pretty sweet. But I also appreciated the Irvine Spectrum did a few things as well to sort of make the experience feel special. So when we walked in, they had an entire booth set up for some of the raffles and some of the things that you could do as the people coming for the Star Wars marathon, and even for the 25th anniversary edition of Phantom Menace. In the lobby for 24 hours straight, they played Star Wars soundtrack music from each of the films. They literally just ran it consecutively, but I'm not gonna lie, it worked really well to set the mood. It was like, despite Fall Guy coming out this week and how special all of that is, it was like, this theater is all about Star Wars. They had commemorative popcorn buckets and cups, which I ended up getting. And in general, they just made it feel like, hey, Star Wars is this moment and we're here for it. It's going to be dope. So I really liked, I mean, the cosplayers, that was definitely fun. It sort of gave a little bit of the convention vibe, Comic-Con, WonderCon.
Yeah, I think the coolest thing they did, and they did not have to do this, and this just goes to show the above and beyond. Around midnight, when the rest of the movies in the theater had finished their run, we had just finished watching Attack of the Clones, and they said, okay, everybody, we are now going to move you into our premier theater, whatever they call it, like 4KX or whatever, with the elite seats, the premier projection, the best audio quality, they said. And they said, hey, we want you guys to have the best experience possible watching these. So let's move down the hall to that theater, and we're going to take it over for the rest of the for the next couple movies. And it was awesome. It was so much better.
Yeah, we got to see Revenge of the Sith, Star Wars: A New Hope, and Empire Strikes Back all on this monster screen, and it was absolutely incredible. So, I mean, I appreciate that. Just in general, I thought the experience overall, at no point was I miserable. I felt the seats were fairly comfortable. I mean, as comfortable as any seat can be that you're sitting in for 24
Yeah, for
hours.
24 hours.
Unlike AMC, though, they did not have recliner seats, which I think actually was a positive to this experience because I'm not going to lie, if the seats reclined, I probably would have fallen asleep.
Probably right.
Yeah. Like I remember I went and saw like The Hobbit, and it was at one of those, what are they called? Like
Sinopolis.
Cinépolis. Yeah. And I fell asleep, but it was because they reclined. I laid back. I think it was also the alcohol, but yeah, I totally knocked out in that movie. And yeah, I feel like that would have happened here. And people did throughout the night sort of take naps or little breaks here and there. I know me personally, CP, you can vouch for this, for the time that, you know, you and Steph were both awake. I did not fall asleep.
I did not see you fall asleep at all.
I stayed up for the 24 hours. I mean, at one point, this movie theater has a coffee stand, which is wild. Mm-hmm. I don't even know how that happens.
Yeah, right.
But I went and got coffee. I was like, and I mean, you could probably, I couldn't even stop smiling when they were going to play A New Hope.
Yeah, dude.
I mean, it's like a dream come true. You know, it's been so long since I've seen these movies. I actually did the math here. A New Hope came out in January 1999. So, 1997. 99 was The Phantom Menace.
Phantom Menace.
So it came out January 1997. And my birthday's in February, so I was technically still 9 years old. I turned 10 a month later. And we, CP, were fortunate enough to go see Star Wars Special Edition in 1997, which mm-hmm. was incredible. But that was the last time I've seen A New Hope. 28 years since I've seen A New Hope.
Isn't
on the
that
big
insane?
Screen. Yeah, and you know, even though I went to the midnight shows and I did go see all the prequel trilogies in the theaters when they released, which was also incredible. I mean, it was original Star Wars that I'm like, other than Return of the Jedi last year when I talked about it on this podcast, because they had the 40th anniversary mm-hmm. edition. Mm-hmm. I think you got to see it in the desert and I got to see it here at the AMC, kind of like Phantom Menace is now. I'm like, I haven't seen them on the big screen. And Star Wars A New Hope is my all-time favorite movie. It's the most fun I have watching a movie. There's just no doubt in my mind. So even though I think, if I'm just being objective, I mean, I love Empire Strikes Back, and it's probably the better movie just outright. Star Wars original is just my favorite all time.
Yeah, I got to bring it up. Weirdest thing happened. Granted, what time would you say we watched Empire Strikes Back? 7 a.m.?
Yeah, I think Star Wars A New Hope started at like 4:30, and it's exactly 2 hours.
Yeah.
So if that runs, that takes you to about 6:30, and there was a 30-minute.
They're doing about 30-minute breaks between every film. So after Empire Strikes Back wrapped, we were walking out, and I was actually with Steph. You had made a run to go get Red Bulls. And I hear this guy in the theater. He's like, yeah, I don't really like Empire Strikes Back. It's kind of boring. I was like, okay, Matt Helson, what are you doing here?
Only guy ever to say that.
Yeah,
I mean,
how could
Empire
you say
is...
this movie is boring? Ugh. You could say it's too heavy. I don't like that all this bad stuff happens, but in no way is it boring.
No, it was incredible. And again, you know, it was fun to be in the theater. So CP, on that note then, how was it just seeing Star Wars on the big screen? So I think you and I, right, I watch Star Wars at a minimum, at least once a year, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. I see it all the time. So what makes the big screen better? You know, what are your thoughts on that? Because, if we have access to these movies, you know, we kind of talked about it a little bit with Spider-Man, like I can watch this movie whenever I want. So why spend the money and give up the 24 hours to go to the theater?
Well, I think two things. For one, I have never watched all 6 Star Wars movies consecutively before.
That is such a great point. I actually don't believe I have either. I have watched both trilogies in mm-hmm. order, mm-hmm. but I don't think I've ever just been like, you know what? I'm going to watch all 6. I mean, right. It's a time commitment for one, but I don't think I've ever done it.
No, neither have I. So definitely got to experience the story in a different way than I ever have before. But the big thing is, I mean, obviously Star Wars looks great on the big screen, but man, it is nice to just push everything else aside. You know, we didn't check our phones. We just watched the movie.
Yeah. And I think the first time I checked my phone during a film, like actually like looking at anything other than just, you know, us taking some quick photos mm-hmm. was Return of the Jedi. Yeah. I think I had pulled my phone out, I think to take photos, and somebody had texted me, and that was the first time. Otherwise, I think me personally, other than snapping a few quick pics, I didn't pull my phone out once. Yeah. I was like, I am focused. I am in on the movie. Just distraction free. And I think that's the big thing is when I'm at home, I do put Star Wars on, but I'm on my phone. Yeah. You know, I'm on my computer. I might be taking notes for FCP. I might be watching it with Steph and we're talking during it, you know. all these things that sort of distract me from being sort of fully engaged with the film in front of me. And because I know Star Wars so well, I've seen it so many times, it's sort of easy to let those distractions happen because I'm like, I know exactly what happens. You know,
I know. I know you were quoting the movie the entire time.
Yeah, I can literally like quote the films
the entire time.
So I thought that was really the big thing. And then surprisingly, yeah, on the big screen, I thought Star Wars, you know, all the films really held up. So
yeah.
I want to make note that we did get the special editions and George Lucas has tinkered with particularly the original trilogy since its release. So we are not necessarily seeing the 1977 version that Vaughn saw in theaters, right? And judging it based on how well that's held up, you know, since 77, we are seeing a digitally enhanced, you know, a cleaned up sort of version of that, which, you know, did play fantastic. It looked amazing. It looked great.
Yeah. You know, the other thing too is there was such a progression through the night. Obviously, it started out with a ton of energy and enthusiasm, but by the time we got to the middle of the original trilogy, it had thinned out. People had obviously gone home, which I don't understand why.
I don't either.
Show up late, don't go home. And I think even during Empire Strikes Back, I tapped you and we look back and literally there's just like 90 people passed out all laying on their side under blankets. I was like, man, of all the movies to fall asleep in, why that one?
Yeah, I thought the energy of our theater was actually great. And it was weird because, like you said, we started off in a sort of standard Regal theater. And I think two things. One, obviously the energy was ridiculously high when Phantom Menace came on. I mean, we were cheering and clapping for like every big moment. It was so much fun. But I also think the smaller theater lent itself to that energy.
Yeah, I think you're right.
It filled out properly. When we moved to the bigger theater, you know, we probably took up at best 50% of the seats in that theater, and it was much bigger. So for the cheering and the clapping, it felt like you would need even more energy to really fill that space rather than in the smaller theater, which was completely full, you know, sold out crowd. That energy, it felt like if everybody just participated, you were right there. But in the bigger theater, yeah, it kind of faded out a little bit because it was like, man, you almost have to make more noise to reach the same level of intensity as you did in the smaller theater. So, but like you mentioned too, there was just a dissipation of some of that energy just because our natural body clocks. Yeah, yeah. Like it's 4:30 in the morning and I'm just freaking tired, even though I'm still pumped. And you can vouch for this, dude. Like 4:30 in the morning, Star Wars A New Hope comes on. I don't think I was as excited at any other point in the entire night.
Oh no, it was actually awesome because you gave me such an energy boost because you start lagging at that time. Everyone else is asleep. It's no longer, and I have to give D-Man props. Him and I really took pride in the fact that we were leading that clapping for most of the day. Even at points that did not deserve clapping, we managed to get some following for it.
Yeah, and you actually started a couple of the claps, which is always exciting because I've started some slow claps myself throughout the years. And you got it going at least 4 or 5 times.
Yeah, dude, it was fun. But yeah, by the time in New Hope, you were just pumped. And I was like, all right, I'm back in this now.
Yeah.
It definitely got tough that late.
But number one, hands down, just any movie on the big screen. And it's why we go back to go see re-releases. It's what makes them great is the theater just commands your attention. The lights go down, you got the big screen in front of you, so there's nothing to take your attention away from the film. You have that, you know, surround sound in your face, and it's like, just put your phone away and engage with the film.
Yep.
And so it's been a while since I've really done that. And on that note, I want to say just, man, after seeing all the films, my biggest takeaway from this experience, which I thought for sure when we did this podcast episode, I would be saying, hands down, the best part of the marathon was getting to see Star Wars A New Hope. Like, no doubt in my mind, I was like, that's going to be the thing I love the most. And ironically, I walked away from this experience thinking, the thing I took away was how much I actually love the prequel trilogy.
I mean, you're going to get a lot of flack for saying that, but I actually agree. And I think part of it is for so long, including seeing it the first time, right? When we saw it, when it was originally released, it was always, this is good. It's not original Star Wars. And I think with the power of time, with now getting to see the completed Anakin Skywalker arc, it definitely hit in a different way.
Yeah, it worked really well.
And we have been overly critical for so long of so many of those films. And I don't think it's really due.
Yeah, because I think, you know, you look at the prequel trilogy and you think to yourself, in its time when it released, people were incredibly critical of it. And, you know, George Lucas has always sort of stated that he did get most of the vision he had for it on the screen. And he's also stated that he made Star Wars as stories that have lessons and are cautionary tales for youth, mm-hmm. you know, which I think is a sort of pointed attack at some of the fandom who, by the time The Phantom Menace released in 1999, who had seen Star Wars in 77, are now adults. Mm-hmm. And they sort of have this preconceived vision of what they, you know, what Star Wars is to them. And George Lucas is like, I'm still making, you know, these movies for youth. And I think that's reflected in no other character better than probably Jar Jar Binks, where he sort of embodies this clumsy, you know, I guess like sort of like buffoon type character who's, you know, always saying the wrong thing, and he's goofy and sort of mm-hmm. causes trouble rather than finds trouble, or trouble finds him. It's like, yeah. No, he always kind of causes his own trouble in his life, but it also gets him out of situations and sometimes allows people the benefit of the doubt to, you know, help him where otherwise you might decline. Because you're like, he just seems like he just needs a hand. But the prequels, you know, they were just not appreciated in their time. And don't get me wrong, I'm not sitting here and saying, wow, after re-watching the prequels on the big screen, they are flawless masterpieces. It's not that there's things about the prequels that it's like, yes, the dialogue is wooden. You know, I still wish, spoiler alert, Darth Maul didn't die at the end of The Phantom Menace. You know, yeah. I would love to see him in each of the films. I mean, it might still to this day be more impactful instead of killing Count Dooku at the beginning of, you know, Revenge of the Sith, if it was Darth Maul and Anakin, you know, finally is doing something like maybe avenging the death of Qui-Gon, or
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
There's,
yeah.
You could have tied these things together, you know, and all the movies do have their weaknesses. So I'm not sitting here and saying, oh my gosh, like, now that I've seen it again, like, they're just perfect masterpieces. No. But what I am saying is that with time, I think we can kind of appreciate the prequels for what they are and what George Lucas was trying to do. And I've said this before in the podcast when we talked about Star Wars, I really appreciate the fact that Lucas didn't just say like, okay, I'm going to make more Star Wars movies, and just did the same original trilogy style, because he had a story he wanted to tell. And I think him setting out, and yes, visually they're different, tonally they're different. And, you know, the story he wanted to tell is about, you know, how does a democracy sort of fall, was mm-hmm. a great story.
Yeah.
But not what original Star Wars is about.
No, it's a different story. He's dealing with different themes, and I think it's appropriate. Also, you know, he made it 20 years later. There's different technology at his disposal. And as a filmmaker who's always pushing the edge of technology, I do respect the fact that he was trying to do different things visually with the prequel trilogy than with the original trilogy.
Even if it upset his current fandom, you mm-hmm. know, which it did. You know, obviously we don't have all the YouTube clips, you know, people talking about it, you know, talking to their camera directly, but there are clips of people, you know, who were talking about it at that time. And it just was not as well received.
Yeah.
And I think the two main things that have helped it over time are that, one, there is an entire generation of kids. I mean, pretty much our generation that grew up with those Star Wars films. They were the ones that they got to see in theaters, right? We were born in 87. The original trilogy had all already been released. You know, it had had its time. And yes, I discovered Star Wars when I was a young kid and loved it. But getting to go to the theater and go see, you know, new Star Wars was the prequel trilogy for me. And yep. we sort of grew up with those films. And I think that ability to sort of age with them has helped them in the long term. People are starting to come around. And then the other thing is the sort of canonization of other things around the prequel trilogy, primarily the Clone Wars. But even now, Disney's doing some exploratory things, you know, bridging gaps with like the Bad Batch or Tales of the Jedi, Tales of the, sort of incorporating certain elements and telling stories within the gaps between Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones and Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith, and expanding on that Star Wars era, the prequel trilogy era. And it has definitely given people, I think, a greater appreciation for those films. Watching them in order on the big screen and seeing the progression that George Lucas was sort of trying to tell, I think the number one thing that stands out for me with the prequel trilogy is the theme of sort of how democracy fails and the galaxy reconfigures into a galactic empire. I think that was like the major standout thing that he accomplished, and it works really well because thematically the prequel trilogy is about how does a person fall to the dark side and how does a societal government structure fall to this, you know,
totalitarianistic dictatorship.
Right. How does that happen? Like, do you do it by force? Do you, you know, which it could be.
Well, and we see that's what J.J. Abrams does in the sequel trilogy. It is through force. But I think you're right. I think watching power, it makes me think of Oppenheimer, right? Kitty has the line about true power waits in the darkness. And we see that unfold as Palpatine waits and strategically tweaks things, concealing his true intentions and letting everybody vote away their freedom and give it to him. I think it's well done.
Yeah, I thought it was well done too. I mean, it literally explores this idea that how does this happen? It happens willingly. People gave up those powers, you know. It's not like it was taken from them and then they sit there after the fact and they're like, oh man, this is total bullshit. Like, we need to rise up and stop this guy because this is crazy. Mm-hmm. They're like, no, we voted for this. We wanted this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's that famous line by Padme where she's like, so this is how liberty dies, you know, with thunderous applause, mm-hmm. or something like that along those lines. You know, I think that sums up a lot of what George Lucas was trying to convey with the prequel trilogy as this cautionary tale about, you know, democracy is fragile. And, you know, by the time you realize that you've lost it, it's probably already too late.
Yep, I agree.
You know, but there's also an inevitability there that I think he's playing with as well, which is all great societies in history have fallen. And it's a slight commentary on, you know, current America, where I don't think he was intentionally doing this, but you can read it this way, which is we're in the middle of one of those great societies. You know, we're very fortunate to be American here. And in a lot of ways, it's a cautionary tale about, like, you know, all great societies fall, even galactic republics, mm-hmm. you know, very Roman Empire sort of look at things. And like, you have to be very cautious. If you give up these powers, you're probably not getting them back. So it's probably going to end poorly. And it does. So one of the elements, though, that I think is conflicting here, and we've talked about, you know, this probably on previous episodes, but I want to address it again, is this idea that Anakin Skywalker has sort of a duality of motives.
Ooh, yeah. Yeah.
So one of them is exactly what we were just talking about, which is there's sort of this underlying plot that culminates in Revenge of the Sith, where Palpatine tells Anakin that the Jedi are planning to overthrow him and overthrow the Republic, right? A Jedi coup, that they want the power for themselves. They're actually pretty selfish, and that's what's going to happen. But the other motive is Anakin's great fear, which is that he will lose those closest to him and lose the ones that he loves. So this stems particularly from his mother having to leave his mother and always sort of longing for that relationship after he goes into the Jedi Order, as well as his premonitions that she might die and Padme might die. Why do you think the having two motives is less powerful than sort of syncing it up into one? Like, why do you think, I don't think it hit quite the way George Lucas intended it to.
I think part of it is the execution on the two motives, because at times they almost seem like they're in direct contrast to each other.
Interesting.
Like, for example, let's think about in Revenge of the Sith, when Anakin Skywalker confronts Mace Windu and he says, "Hey, I think there's a Sith Lord. I think it's Palpatine." And Mace Windu says, "Hey, we're going to go arrest him. Like, we're going to take care of it. We are going to take him out of power and restore power to the Senate because he's a bad guy." And that all works, except for the fact that then Anakin Skywalker shows up to confront Mace Windu and say, "Hey, you know, no, we can't." Mace Windu makes the decision that the Jedi are going to have to kill Palpatine because he's a Sith Lord.
And yeah, he Anakin says something like, "He controls the courts, he controls the Senate. Like, yes. Even if we had a trial, it'll never be fair."
And then Anakin shows up, the voice of someone truly believing in the system, and he's like, "No, he has to stand trial. You know, he's going to be made into a martyr. We need him to face justice." Well, that's incredible. And that gets into this whole conversation about power. That whole argument is then watered down with the next line where Anakin follows it up and says, "But I need him to live."
Yeah.
Referencing the fact that he needs Palpatine to show him these powers of the dark side that Darth Plagueis left to Anakin Skywalker. I'm sorry. How to save Padme from death. And the problem is both of those are at opposite ends of motivation. And because Lucas is throwing both of those at us in the same scene, I think it cheapens both of them to some extent.
Yeah, I do agree. I think the whole idea, like, "I need him," is a selfish motive, right? He's like, "I need him in order to explore these elements of the Force so I can save the ones I love. So I don't want you to kill him for selfish reasons." But then on the other side of that coin is like, he should stand trial and justice should be served because democracy is delicate. And if we make him a martyr, you know, things will fail anyway. And that's sort of selfless. That's like the grander vision of like, I don't want, you know, the whole Old Republic to fall because we did the selfish, you know, we did this thing. But those are sort of at odds, because it's almost like when he says, "I need him," the selfish motive sort of overrides this other thing. And so that all culminates later when he's fighting Obi-Wan and he says, "From my point of view, the Jedi are evil." But you're kind of like, do you really believe that? Like, really?
Yeah. Yeah, right. It's like, no.
Like, knowing what you know now, he was a Sith Lord. Like,
and you pledged yourself to him as a Sith Lord after you killed a bunch of Jedi, by the way.
Yeah, like, you know, you can't now recognize that you went and killed a bunch of younglings. You know, you went and killed a bunch of kids and that's bad. Like, all of a sudden you're like, no, it needed to be done. I'm like, it just seems like too dramatic of a turn, in the sense that you're like, I don't know if you yourself, maybe you're lying to yourself, but I don't know if you would believe it. Seems like the selfish motive won out and you're like, I'd rather do whatever I need to do to save the ones I love. And if that means doing some evil, dastardly shit, then so be it. But it doesn't seem like he would truly believe the Jedi were evil. Even though Mace Windu does sort of play out that coup storyline, you know, where he's like, I am going to kill him because, you know, I don't think democracy will hold him accountable, you know, or sort of insinuating that maybe democracy is already too far along into this sort of dictatorship that it won't be able to hold him to account.
Yeah, and I think that's great. I think the problem just is, again, George Lucas has two major themes that really need to be explored to the full extent, and we just don't get that in three movies. You know, this was the season of a show. We could have really dived into the minuteness, and instead, some of these scenes, I think Reed is a bit clunky because there's these dual motives and there's so much character growth and so many decisions that they're faced at the same time. I mean, again, Anakin's fear of loss. This is something that is quite evident through each of the three prequel movies, right? When he's brought before the council at the beginning, Yoda calls him on the fact that he has fear and he has this attachment to his mother. But then from a thematic perspective, it's kind of dismissed and they're like, well, he can't be trained. He's too old. But it's never clearly stated that the reason why he can't train because he's too old is because he has been corrupted by feelings and this attachment that he's grown to his mother, which truly prevent him from embracing the call and the lifestyle of being a Jedi.
Yeah. And I think, too, you bring up a good point where the way they say it is like he's too old, which Yoda says that to Luke as well, that too old to complete the training. You know, I think when, especially when they're talking about Anakin, when he's a young boy, it almost comes across as if they're like, there's just an, like, he's older than five.
Yeah. So he can't learn the stuff.
Too old.
Too much to learn. Yeah.
But I think you're right. What they're actually talking about is not a specific age. They're just saying he's already formed these attachments.
Mm-hmm.
And to that end, it's going to be really hard for him to let that go. It is hard, right? I think Yoda has a conversation with him later where he's like, you know, when our loved ones die, like, mourn them not, miss them, do not, you know, and sort of you embrace the fact that they're one with the Force and you know, have to sort of continue to move on. Whether that's true, sound advice, I don't know. I mean, I think everybody's sad when people they love go. But the message is, like, don't form these attachments to the degree that Anakin does, which is, I want to prevent death. His fear leads him down this path to try to do something that messes with the natural way of things in order to prevent his fears from happening.
Well, or even when Anakin embraces the Jedi lifestyle, right? He tells Qui-Gon, hey, I want to be the first person to see all this, to go to every star system. You know, as a Jedi, I want to come back and free the slaves. His embrace of the Jedi lifestyle is not embracing the Jedi code and the Jedi values. He wants to become a Jedi for this very heroic nature that he believes it lends him, which, you know, if he was brought into the Jedi Order as an infant, like everyone else, he probably wouldn't have been raised with those motivations.
Yeah, and I think it does work well, the idea that, right, he sort of is there selfishly using the Jedi teachings as a means to an end. It's like Lucas left all the correct sort of breadcrumbs to get us all the way there, but he doesn't connect all the dots.
Yeah,
to the maximum to really make it hit in that emotional way. Yeah.
Yeah.
He like gets it all the way there where you're like, you can almost see right from the very beginning, like Anakin is using this opportunity to learn all these new skills to do certain things that it's like, yeah, but Jedi are selfless. You know, if you dedicate yourself to the Jedi code, you don't selfishly come back and free these slaves. It's what are the missions of the Jedi? And if that includes that, then yes. But if it doesn't, and there's more important things, like you got to go do those things.
Yes.
So, because there's only so many Jedis. But on that note, you know, one of the other things that really stood out to me watching the entire prequel trilogy in order was mentions of the prophecy. So they have a prophecy that they never state explicitly, like what it was sort of word for word, you know, which I think, I don't know if it happens in the films, but in Harry Potter, he does actually see the prophecy about, you know, it's technically not about him. It's about someone. And they end up sort of showing you exactly what that prophecy was, where here we never quite see it. They just say that somebody with a high midichlorian count or somebody with a vergence in the Force, very strong in the Force, will bring balance. And they reference that, but they never state the prophecy directly. But do you even think the prophecy was necessary? What do you think about the addition of that?
I actually don't. I think rewatching the story all the way through, I actually think it was a disservice to include the prophecy. And I only bring that up because when we jump ahead to the original trilogy, there is no conversation of prophecy. There's a conversation of destiny, and it is the destiny of Luke Skywalker being linked to his father.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it is Luke becoming the Jedi Knight that his father fell away from to essentially redeem his father for being the man that he was, right? That's what Luke's destiny is. And Yoda and Obi-Wan both talk about that in different ways, but in no way are they saying that this is about being a chosen one. bringing balance to the Force. That is something that is brought up in episode one. And I think it's a disservice because I think originally Lucas is using this as a writing tool to bring some urgency and motivation to why Qui-Gon feels so compelled to bring Anakin into the Jedi Order. But I think simply him saying, look, this is the kid with the highest midichlorian count we've ever seen. He needs to be a Jedi. I think would have been strong enough at the time.
Yeah, because, you know, the whole idea that, like, his mother, you know, Anakin was conceived through the Force, I think sort of has some Christianity parallels.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like, hey, this is, you know, a chosen one narrative. But I don't know that the story ever sort of sees that through. You know, it's mentioned even at the pinnacle moment, you know, Obi-Wan yelling at him, like, it was said that you would, you know, destroy the Sith, not join them. And I think Yoda mentions that, like, the prophecy misread, it was, you know, like, they're toying with this idea that they're aware of the prophecy and maybe it's not what everybody thinks it is. But I think because they never tell us what it is, we're left to sort of search for something. And I think the word balance is the word that comes out.
I think you're absolutely right.
The most is, like, if you look at the dynamics when the Phantom Menace starts, if there's a prophecy that says somebody will balance the Force, it seems like the Force is out of balance, favoring the Jedi.
Right. They don't even know that the Sith have reemerged until the end of the movie.
Yeah, you know, I think Darth Maul says, you know, we will reveal ourselves to the Jedi. We will reveal that the Sith have returned or something. And so they don't even know that that's around. And you end up with this sort of like, wow, you guys were so high on yourselves that you couldn't see that it's out of balance in your favor, that like the prophecy itself might be saying that there'll be someone incredibly powerful that will return to, you know, balance things with the Sith. And I mean, it goes the other way, right? It shifts the scale to favor the Sith. You know, all the Jedi sort of get wiped out and Luke comes and sort of equals this equation at the very end. But I think it's weird because I think when we read that word balance, you know, what we're thinking of is, I think, like, on a scale, right? We're looking at it like there's the good side and the dark side, or the light side and the dark side.
Absolutely.
And so we're looking at, like, oh, the scale needs to read equal. But when I hear the word balance, I think what I'm taking from that prophecy is sort of like the natural order of things. And it's a restoration of power. And so I don't know that it actually means like it'll straight up balance the Jedi and the Sith and they're equal. I don't think that's what it's talking about. I think it's just saying like restoring balance to the Force is like people aren't using it for power. And I think that's what Luke does. He restores the Force back to sort of the people, and that it just is. You know, it's not the Jedi in power. It's not the Sith in power. It's like, hey, the Force is here for all of us, and we're restoring it to that sort of natural way of things. So, but yeah, I don't know. In this case, like using the chosen person sort of, you know, chosen one trope, I don't know that it's necessary. Because it's like you already have this, you know, sort of crumbling democracy. You're playing with motivations there. Then you have Anakin's fear and his desire to save Padme from death and childbirth. And then you're adding in this chosen one. It feels a little muddled. Too much.
Yeah, I think that's probably the biggest difference. When you look at the original trilogy, thematically, it's very straightforward. And the addition of the chosen one narrative, I think, is too much. Especially to the sense that we are deceived at the end. And
yeah,
Anakin is not the chosen one that he thought he was. But also, even the elements that are presented at the beginning of the Phantom Menace with this child conceived by the Force and things like that, they don't really ever go anywhere.
Yeah.
I almost it's think it mentioned. Would have been more interesting if Anakin had some father that we didn't know who he was, and you know, in some way that popped up more as a story thread than these other things that Lucas is playing with that he just sort of ignores down the line.
I do really enjoy that theme of Star Wars, which is the familial dynamic of fathers and sons. You know, Anakin doesn't have a father, but he looks up to Qui-Gon, and it's interesting. Watching Revenge of the Sith, I noticed that Anakin describes his relationship with Obi-Wan as a father that he never had. But Obi-Wan describes it as, "You were my brother."
That's very interesting.
Yeah. They see their dynamic slightly differently. And it works in the sense that I think with Anakin, it is his own son that he didn't know that he had that restores the sort of good in his soul.
Well, and what I think is incredible about that, right? And I know you and I've talked about this, so I'll keep it brief. When Anakin is confronted by Obi-Wan, Obi-Wan confronts him from a position of strength. He beats Anakin in a fight. And while he's victorious, he does not redeem Anakin Skywalker. He lets him slip away completely into the dark side. Yet when Luke confronts his father in the same kind of dynamic that Obi-Wan did as a father-son, right? Luke does not confront his father with force. He surrenders to him, forcing him to choose the path of light. And I think that that's kind of amazing, looking at that sort of, you know, Lucas emulating the same pattern between both these father-son situations to show why Anakin fell further into the depths of the darkness and then why Luke was able to pull him out.
Yeah. And it works really well. I mean, obviously at the end of Revenge of the Sith, when Anakin is in this moment, he's, you know, enveloped by flame and lava, and he sort of is, you know, turned into the Darth Vader that we know, right? He's screaming at Obi-Wan, "I hate you," you know. He's been totally consumed by hate. It is interesting that it is Luke that is able to restore that through, like, inaction, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, inaction is the wrong word. Like, he's choosing to do something, but like you said, non-force. Mm-hmm. He's like, fine, you know, in an incredibly powerful moment. It's the completion of an amazing arc when he looks at his hand. You know, I think other people have said this, but, you know, a handful of irony or a lack of,
he's like,
"Oh man, I could end up like my dad. And, you know, is that my destiny to do that?" And he turns around and throws his lightsaber away. And he's like, "No, it's not my destiny. Yeah. You know, I refuse to join you and kill my dad. I'm not going to do it. You can't make me do it. You know, no, Your Highness, I am a Jedi like my father before me." And it's incredibly powerful. The Emperor knows it too. Mm-hmm. So be it, Jedi. You know, he recognizes Luke as a Jedi in that moment. He's like, "Ah, damn it. Thought I could corrupt this kid." Yep. And I'm going to have to kill him.
Oh, that's so good.
But that deflection of sort of Luke's choice and putting it on Darth Vader and betting everything that his own father still has good in him, which Luke acknowledges he's felt it through the Force. He's mm-hmm. like, "There is still good in you. I felt it." But the ability to sort of throw that back to Vader and really complete the arc of all six films in that Vader's the one that has to make the decision, not Luke.
Yep.
Really makes those six films feel complete. You know, it was Palpatine this whole time that's been pulling these strings and doing all this stuff. And finally, he's able to do that. And even if, you know, by doing it, Darth Vader returns to the light side and the good side and redeems his soul. I mean, he's done too much bad stuff to not be held to account. Mm-hmm. You know, if the galaxy was indeed going to have a trial of Darth Vader, like, he would deserve whatever his punishment is. He's done way too many bad things. But the idea that you can redeem someone's soul is such a powerful thing because, yeah, we all have done bad things and we do need to be held account and pay for our crimes. We do, you know, when we commit them. But that doesn't mean that your soul can't be redeemed. Even if you're sitting in jail, there's still hope for you. And it's just such a powerful story. And I think it works really well. So, but I do also want to talk a little bit, CP, about some of the changes and stuff that happened with the original trilogy. So, for instance, and this is going to get you a little pumped up, but Han does not shoot first. Now he shoots simultaneously.
Yeah, don't like it. In fact, you know what shocked me? I think I was the only person that booed in the theater when that happened. I don't know if everybody's asleep or what.
Yeah, it probably was like 5 a.m.
I was like, what, how is nobody else upset about this?
It was the first time we ever got to see McClunky on the big screen, which that was the last change that George Lucas made to the original trilogy before he sold it to Disney. And actually, the first time it aired was on Disney Plus, but he had made the changes prior. Yeah. So for anybody that doesn't know, there's a scene in A New Hope where George Lucas changed the dynamic between Greedo and Han Solo, which originally Han just shoots and kills Greedo instead of, Greedo trying to arrest him as a bounty hunter. And Lucas had changed it to have Greedo shoot first because the whole thing was he was like, oh, Han's not a cold-blooded murderer. But we're like,
yes, maybe. Is.
Yeah, like kind of.
He kind
at,
of
at that time. Yeah, at that time, possibly.
Maybe well, anyway, Return of the Jedi Han, no, but yes.
So Lucas has toyed with this through the years. Everybody knows this, right? Special editions and different variations with DVDs and stuff. He's sort of like changed the timing of who actually shot first. You know, Han shot first is like the famous phrase for A New Hope. And at this time, he has them sort of both shooting simultaneously, and then Han shoots again and kills Greedo. But with this last iteration of changes, he includes this random out of place moment where Greedo just goes, McClunky. And everybody was like, why is that in there?
Yeah.
Like, why did he do that? And I have no idea.
I don't know either.
And so that was the first time I got to see that on the big screen, which was pretty cool. But I guess owing to this conversation of Lucas changing things as he goes, we've talked before on this podcast that I personally am not a huge fan of changing movies after they've been released. I think by doing that, you sort of go down this Pandora's box of, you know, you can change the meaning of things later, which I don't necessarily like. I think movies are not supposed to be malleable like that, where they're constantly being reimagined, you know, for what you feel now. I like the idea that when you release something, it says something. And even if you disagree with your own work later, it still needs to stand and allow people to engage with it. And Lucas is one of those filmmakers who, you know, has sort of said through the years that Star Wars in particular didn't meet his vision for what he originally intended. And so he wanted the ability to use the technology of the day to go back and sort of complete his vision. But I'm just not a huge fan of that. But I also like a lot of the changes that he did. I enjoy the version that we have now. I'm not a 1977 Star Wars theatrical release purist. You know, even though those cuts are out there or as close as they can be to that original cut, which Lucas, again, refuses to acknowledge or release. He won't do it. And thankfully, I'm glad that Disney honors his request and does not do it. This is George Lucas's saga. And even though he sold it and Disney has the right to do it if they wish, I like that they respect his wishes. But I do like the changes, most of them. I think the number one that stands out that I'm not the biggest fan of is Return of the Jedi, the song at Jabba's Palace.
Yeah, that's just so unnecessary to me.
I think the CG and some of the stuff doesn't fit really well.
Well, we don't ever watch songs play out. This isn't Lord of the Rings where, you know, they sing songs and, you know, as a part of the story. So it feels out of place. Some of the original trilogy changes I do like. I like the addition of the Jabba scene
in A New Hope.
I think that helps complete the Han Solo arc because we really understand what's at stakes here for him and why he needs to leave at the end of A New Hope with the reward and what the costs are when he decides that in fact he is going to help Luke and stay with the rebellion. I like the decision to change Boba Fett's voice so it's more consistent with the Jango voice that we've heard early on, since that is supposed to be the same character. I like the idea to replace the woman Palpatine with Palpatine.
Yeah. In the Empire Strikes Back scene.
Yeah, making it cohesive, but most of the Return of the Jedi ones I feel are kind of unnecessary. I don't like
the Sarlacc pit.
Yeah, that's so stupid.
I really love the idea of, it's like an inverse of sort of Dune. You have these sandworms that can travel through sand, where in Return of the Jedi originally, it was a static hole in the ground, like a garbage disposal. And you just threw things in there. And, you know, it would take 1,000 years to, you know, digest in the pit of Carcoon.
Yeah.
And they change it and add this beak that comes up that just changes the dynamic of a hole in the desert. Now it feels like it's a creature living in a hole. And that, I don't know, I don't like the beak. I like the idea that the hole was the thing.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Like, I used to have a little playset, you know, one of those like Micro Machines playsets with Star Wars figures, and you could literally like throw them in the hole and like then have it swallow them.
Yeah.
It was really cool. So I like that. I mean, you know, it's interesting. I think one of the things that stood out, and I don't know if we've talked about this on the podcast, but I think you and I have talked about it, is in Return of the Jedi, there's sort of a lack of acknowledgement that the last time Han Solo saw Lando Calrissian was when he betrayed them. And yet they seem very friendly.
Yeah.
For a majority, like, of the film, like he's cool with him, even though it makes sense that Han would arrive there eventually. You know, I think the last time he even talked to Lando directly, he punched him in the face. And so, I don't know, it was kind of weird that they don't address that at all. You know,
even to the point that, like, he shows up on the skiff and they're about to be thrown into Sarlacc, and he's not even like, you know what, screw you, Lando, you deserve to get eaten. Like, he's literally right into it trying to save him. And I just think that that's weird. And I know that obviously Han Solo has grown through the previous two films, but that still seems out of character.
Yeah, I mean, I know Lucas, you know, there's a whole thing with Gary Kurtz, the producer of A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back, leaving the franchise because him and Lawrence Kasdan, the writer for Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, believed that a character should be killed off, namely Han Solo, to really make the fates of all the other characters be in question, so that we would be like, oh my God, like, Luke could die. And realistically, if you're at the what is considered a conclusion of a trilogy, and a main character does die, then that has to be on the table, right?
No,
the audience
I agree.
Should believe Luke could die.
But I also think that's the proper completion to Han Solo's arc.
Yeah, he goes from totally selfish mercenary killer to sacrificing himself to save his friends and the cause, right? The rebellion cause. And he does like the most selfless thing you could do, which is sacrifice yourself. And I do agree that I think that probably would have been the proper way to end it. I get two reasons why you wouldn't. In one, Lucas wanted a sort of happy ending, happy conclusion. And with Han Solo dying and the original vision for Luke sort of being a Western ending where he's walking off into the sunset and it's not this sort of feel good Ewok celebration, would provide a sort of a dampened ending where it's a little bit more bittersweet than it is celebratory.
Yeah.
And then I think too, there was a little bit of overkill in that the first third of the film is dedicated to saving Han Solo only to have him die. Like, narratively, I kind of understand that, like, if you're going to dedicate such a big chunk of the movie to saving the guy and then just kill him off like two scenes later, doesn't really work for me. I don't really like that either. So I'm not sure exactly how you would have to restructure it to sort of make that feel more organic, or not like we just wasted the first, you know, third of the film.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess if the Han Solo sacrifice is truly grand enough, then it could pay off, right?
Yeah, I mean, it should, because then it would mean that, hey, we took all this time to go save him. Well, if we hadn't done that and he sacrificed himself now, he wouldn't have been here.
Yeah.
Right. And then we wouldn't be alive. So thanks to Han and thanks to our efforts for saving him, we could have got that. But at the same time, I do think the narrative arc for the original trilogy that works is Luke's, and it does hit ridiculously hard. There is a cathartic moment when he stands up to the Emperor and says, like, no, Your Highness, I am a Jedi like my father before me. It's not the lightsaber battle. It's not, it's Luke's acknowledgement that I will not be using force to kill both my father and you. I'm not going to do it.
Yep.
And I think it works really good as a conclusion to the original trilogy. What are your thoughts about Return of the Jedi, never as intended, sort of being like the capper, the conclusion to the whole first six episode saga?
Well, I don't think it's as powerful. I really don't. When you look at this storyline, which is the rise and fall of Anakin Skywalker, yes, we get the redemption, but it just doesn't feel truly as grand as I think it should be if it is the conclusion of six movies before it. In fact, I would argue it maybe is one of the weakest films in Star Wars.
Interesting, because it's also one of the most beloved.
Yep.
People do love Return of the Jedi, and it's a movie that, I mean, there's been lots of divisiveness associated with it, you know, particularly the Ewoks, you know.
Yeah.
Are they annoying? They're thematically, they work, right? It's supposed to be nature versus machine, and it's supposed to be the power of the will of the people versus, you know, the soldiers.
Yeah.
But there's always sort of been this crux in Return of the Jedi where people are like, the Emperor made this quote where he's like, that's my elite fighting squad of stormtroopers. So this is like his like elite squad, and they got beat by these little teddy bears.
Yeah.
You know, and there's always sort of been, I think even How I Met Your Mother has a scene where they remark where Barney's like, if you were born before this date, you hate the Ewoks. But if you were this old and you saw them, you love them.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
And so I think, you know, Return of the Jedi has always sort of been a little divisive in that way. But I mean, I think it works particularly for the original trilogy as an ending, but not necessarily for the whole six movies. I think Lucas really tries to rectify this with the montage and the music update, because if you remember, we got the Yub Nub Ewok song in the original version. And I don't even know if they do a montage back. I think it's just celebratory on the forest moon of Endor.
Yeah.
But now there's a montage that sort of goes from like Cloud City to Tatooine to Naboo to Coruscant,
places that we've been
over all six films. And you can see Lucas sort of trying to tie this all together. But I wanted to make note that watching it in order from one through six, the one moment that really stood out for me and hit really hard watching them in order was that one of the most divisive changes he made was he put the ghost of Anakin Skywalker as Hayden Christensen and not Sebastian Shaw, as is originally the version we got, which is Sebastian Shaw is the actor who plays Darth Vader when he has his mask removed and talks to Luke. And he says, you know, you already have, you know, tell your sister you were right.
Yeah.
You were right. No. So he's the original Force Ghost. And instead, Lucas changes it back to Hayden Christensen. And I think for a long time, I've always been in the camp that I actually like the idea of Sebastian Shaw as the ghost. I like Anakin being redeemed in the moment that he was redeemed, and that as a Force Ghost, he would be representative of the dad that Luke actually met face to face. They locked eyes, and he saw his dad for the first time. I like that original version. But after having seen all six episodes, I'm not going to lie. Having it be Hayden Christensen, Anakin version, hit really hard as making Return of the Jedi a capper conclusion for all six. It felt very restorative to the journey that we've been on this entire time. The slight reminder that, you know, it just takes you all the way back to the very beginning in that moment. And you can't help but see him and think of that little boy that you met in Watto's shop, that, you know, sort of these flashes of moments in your head of him and Obi-Wan, and here he is smiling and seeing his son. And it really worked. It really worked for me. It was remarkable.
My only problem with that is, again, why do we get young Anakin Force Ghost, but we get old Obi-Wan and old Yoda? And I feel like if that's the way, and when you become a Force Ghost, you get to be however you are, then why do we not have, you know, Ewan McGregor instead of Alec Guinness?
Yeah, no, I get that, you know, right? They're both old in the versions in the way they went. It also opens up the door to, like, do Force Ghosts get to choose the form that they look like? Or, you know, I think to myself, like, you know, if it was the Sebastian Shaw version of Anakin, like if he wouldn't have any legs or like one arm, and
Yeah,
he'd
right.
just be like a lump over there. So he'd need, you know, robotics or like a wheelchair or something as a ghost. I'm like, I don't know. Well, yeah, it's just sort of, it's a little bit of world building that sort of has to take the hit here, the certain level of consistency, you know, in favor of thematics. And like I said, I thought it actually worked really well when watching all six episodes in order. And again, as the way that Lucas has stated, it's intended to be viewed. So, which again, there's elements of this that, right, as originally released, when Darth Vader makes his revelation in Empire Strikes Back, no, I am your father, was shocking both to Luke and the audience because nobody knew this. But if you watch the movies now, the way Lucas says it, they're intended to be watched from episode one all the way through six, that should never be shocking for the audience.
Yeah.
He changed the context of that reveal. You know, I think now you've seen those videos on YouTube where they have little kids, you know, turning around and looking at their parents and like, is he really his father? And that's probably because the parents were, you know, correct in showing their kids Star Wars in the order it was released. You know, so that surprise can be, you know, remained intact for somebody that's never seen it. But yeah, if you watch it in order, that should never be a surprise for the audience, just for Luke. I don't know. He changes a few things. And the Anakin Force Ghost, I think, to me now, watching it that way, is probably one of my favorite parts. It did cause me to sort of look backward at the entire saga up to that point versus just the original trilogy.
Fair
but
enough.
I agree with you. I don't know if Return of the Jedi is quite epic enough to be a capper for all six.
Yeah, you know? it just feels like there's an element missing. And granted, you know, I think obviously there's a lot of tonal and structural changes between the prequel trilogy and the original trilogy. You know, because of the nature of the visual effects, the original trilogy is much darker.
Yeah.
The prequel trilogy, because of CGI, the scenes are a lot fuller with a lot more characters than in the original trilogy.
Yep.
The original trilogy, each movie has three or four or five completing sort of thematic lines and plot lines versus the original trilogy, which is very straightforward. But for having to bear the weight of the five movies before it, I don't know that Return of the Jedi is now up to the task in the way that it was when we were only considered against the other two films in the original trilogy.
Yeah, I think it works perfectly for the original trilogy, right? It's a great ender for the trilogy. I think as an ender for the saga, it doesn't quite get us there just because there's very few references naturally within Return of the Jedi that refer to, you know, you think with Palpatine, you might have some lines referencing the Old Republic and sort of the Empire. When Luke talks to Yoda, you think maybe if you were to do it with the prequel trilogy in mind, he might mention the prophecy, you know, or Obi-Wan's ghost bringing that up. They sort of, it connects correctly, but it feels like you would add a few more elements to really make it feel like one long narrative.
Agreed.
So I wanted to ask you, seeing it on the big screen, were there any elements that you thought maybe didn't age as well or don't hold up? You know, I think one that stands out for me is maybe the speeder bike scene. It does feel a little bit like they're on like green screen or blue screen.
Yeah.
Probably blue because they're in a forest.
Yeah.
I highlight the screen. Blue screen. And it sort of shows up in the viewing experience where you're like, I remember, you know, I've heard people say that at the time of its release, that was a highlight of Return of the Jedi, that people spoke so positively about that chase scene. And, you know, all these years later, I look at it and I'm like, I mean, it does feel like people sitting on a thing in front of a screen at times, you know, even though it still does its best.
Yeah. Especially since the rest of the, you know, the Star Wars movies have all been enhanced, right? And I imagine they're much cleaner visually than the old ones. That still looks like 80s technology that we don't really see used in the same way as in the 1980s when that was commonplace.
Yeah, like there's definitely a shot in Return of the Jedi 2 where I think Lando's in front of the Millennium Falcon and like him and Han are saying bye. And you can just sort of really tell that that shot of the Falcon is a matte painting,
Yeah.
where you're like, yeah, it looks like they're that's not really there. So, and
Which
that's not a
I.
knock to the matte painting. It's probably actually like the lighting and framing of the shot itself. Because who
Yeah.
knows? There's probably other shots that I don't know.
Well, I
And
mean,
they'd be
when you
like, yeah,
think
it
about all the
is.
matte work in Empire Strikes Back, and I mean, it is freaking gorgeous.
Yeah, you can't tell at all.
It's
So, I mean,
gorgeous.
that one just stands out to me a little bit, but I think overall, like, it looks pretty good. I think if anything, maybe the prequel trilogy does have some elements where they look like CG of the time, 2002, 1999.
Yeah. Some of it's a little dated. So I mean, some of it's, surprisingly still looks very good. I think more of the dated component is probably really in the Phantom Menace. And I think it's some of like the Gungan army versus the droid army, where you're like, yeah, this looks like it's out of an old video game.
Yeah, like it all just looks sort
It's
of
just
with
there's
a
so much
CG
CG on the screen.
shine.
Yeah.
So I think there's a scene where the bounty hunter, the changeling from Attack of the Clones, gets shot with the Kaminoan dart,
Yeah.
Kaminoan dart or whatever. And then, like, sort of the face changes into the thing. But I'm like, if you look at that, it looks like very poor CG.
Yeah.
It doesn't even look like it has correct textures. Like, it almost looks like a model
Yeah.
from on the computer, but it hasn't been texturized properly.
Yeah.
There's things like that that show up where I'm like, But overall, I thought it worked fairly well. It looks great on the big screen. I mean, one of the things that stood out too is like the pacing of the prequel trilogy. I remember thinking to myself, there's a lot of blocks of dialogue, some exposition dumps, political talk at the Senate hearings, but the pacing of those movies is actually pretty brisk.
You know, I always think back that it's just people on Coruscant debating power, and it's a much quicker paced movie than I thought, which is probably in the TikTok generation why younger people really do love the prequel trilogy so much, because it's very fast paced.
Yeah. I did enjoy that. I think one of the standout scenes for me still is one of my favorite scenes of all time, the Death Star trench run in A New Hope.
Yeah.
It is funny if you were to put it up against like the mission from Top Gun Maverick. I
Yeah.
mean, they're pretty close. They even have some of the same lines.
Right.
I think they say some of the things I like. It's almost ironic because you have that scene in Top Gun Maverick where Maverick says something like, "Don't think, kid, do." And it almost comes off at exactly the same moment where Obi-Wan comes in and he's like, use the force, Luke.
Yeah.
It's this
Yeah.
mentor figure sort of giving you this advice,
Yeah.
let go, Luke. Like they're literally saying something
Yep.
similar. And I mean, the mission's the same. You have to hit this really tiny target. They're flying ships through a trench. Like the whole thing, you're like, wow. No wonder I love Top Gun Maverick. Because that scene is just incredible. And I love, even at the end, Han Solo comes back, right? And, comes in and sort of saves the day. And if you watch timing wise, Top Gun, Maverick comes in when Rooster's gonna get hit and he sort of comes in and takes the bullets and
Sure.
sacrifices himself. You're like, it's all there.
Yeah, no, you're right.
I mean, but God, just, yeah, draw inspiration from great scenes. And that's one of them.
Yeah, right.
Getting to see Luke and Darth Vader fight on Bespin was incredible. I remember I was super stoked waiting for that moment when Darth Vader comes out and they're on the platform and he's like going at Luke. He's terrifying.
Oh, it's great.
On the big screen, I mean, larger than life. I was
Yeah.
like glued to the screen. Just incredible.
Yeah, oh my gosh. It's such an amazing, powerful moment.
Yeah,
And
I thought,
again, just everything about it works so well. The music, the lighting.
oh,
Kushner does
director.
so much with the light and the smoke and the shadows in that entire sequence with the confrontation between Luke and Vader.
And I gotta give a huge nod to the AT-ATs, the AT-ATs, on Hoth. They're stop motion, and it looks stunning.
No, considering that it's stop motion from 1980, it looks great.
Yeah, I'm like, this looks incredible. And I mean, they knocked that out of the park. Yeah, I can't, I'm trying to think. There's not that many moments where I'm like, ooh, this doesn't work. God, I just love Star Wars. I mean, I'm not going to lie. CP, I am going to, you know, admit here that, yeah, when I left the theater, I was like, honestly, I want to watch more Star Wars.
Dude. Well, okay, so let's talk about that. I ended up leaving after Return of the Jedi. Because I know that there's only six Star Wars movies, but you stuck around and watched three more.
Yeah, I did watch Disney Star Wars. I watched the sequel trilogy. And again, as Sean mentioned in the shout outs, he's like, now it's time for the bad ones. I don't feel that way. I think when I look at the Disney sequel trilogy, they do a lot of things that work well. So like with The Force Awakens, my heavy criticism of it was that it's incredibly derivative of Star Wars A New Hope, right?
Yeah.
Starts off on a desert planet with a droid that has secret plans, you know, to a map. And they sort of go on this adventure. And I just found it to be incredibly derivative. But it is a lot of fun. It captures the spirit of A New Hope, too, which is that it's a really fun movie, you know, a la The Matrix, a la Pirates of the Caribbean, Curse of the Black Pearl, right? You're following sort of a hero's journey structure, but it's an adventure. It's a good time. Mm-hmm. And I think it works to that end. I just thought it was a little bit derivative. But it does a good job of introducing the characters and sort of, you know, bringing everybody into like, hey, Star Wars is back. And I think it accomplished that mission. Now, The Last Jedi has some faults, which I've acknowledged on a previous episode of this podcast, where I think they take the stories right up to these moments for the characters. If they had gone a little bit further, it might have been more interesting to explore in the following film, which is mm-hmm. like the character of Rey walks right up to the moment where she gets her big reveal, which is that her parents were no one. She has no place in the story. And it's a devastating blow to somebody who's trying to find her place. Mm-hmm. And yet the main character, Kylo Ren, is like, but not to me. You're important to me. And I feel like as a character, it would be interesting if she had given into that impulse and that her great weakness, her great fear, led her down a dark path and she sort of has to find her way back. I think that would be more interesting than it is in the film where she rejects that and just sort of is on the side of good.
Yeah.
You know, they adhere cleanly to that sort of good versus evil and they don't want to explore anybody going dark.
Yeah.
Which it's Disney, so sort of makes sense, but I think that would have been more interesting having a moment like Luke Skywalker, but making the different decision, right? Darth Vader,
yeah,
join me and together we can end this destructive conflict. We can rule the galaxy as father and son. I'm sure part of Luke was like, I mean, it'd be cool to get to know my dad, but like, fuck off. Like, I'm never joining you, you know?
Yeah.
And here, I think it would have been cool if Rey had done that. And I think they have the two other main characters, Poe and Finn. Yeah, FN2187. And Finn actually ends up in a scenario where he's looking at sort of good versus bad in terms of resistance versus First Order, or rebellion versus Empire, good guys versus bad guys. And he meets this character who's like, it's all a machine. Like, and he sort of shows Finn, like, there's these arm dealers and they're dealing to both sides, right? Like, they're everybody's sort of part of the war machine. And he's a character who started off as a stormtrooper, then he joined the resistance, but he hasn't found his place. And I thought it might have been interesting if they explore that gray area and then eventually he's forced to take a side. Now, how they do that, I would have loved to have seen, but I think that would be more interesting from a character standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, Poe, who is a, you know, standout star resistance fighter pilot, X-Wing pilot.
He's also Paul Atreides' dad.
Yeah. And he, I mean, he's generally like well-respected within the resistance. Well, in The Last Jedi, he leads essentially a mutiny. And instead of like being held to account and ending up in jail and sort of having to become a rebel to the rebels, mm-hmm. They just are sort of like, oh, you know.
No harm, no foul.
Yeah. Like I really like him. And then they just move on like that never happened. And you're like, what a waste. Like, it would have been really cool to see all of these characters sort of operating outside even the authority of the resistance and doing some own, you know, some own, their own missions on their own.
Yeah.
I think would have been cool. And then sort of taking up that leadership mantle by leading and not just having it placed upon you. Mm-hmm. That could have been cool. So I would have loved to have seen them explore that. I mean, there's still the things that stand out, like Space Leia, which I think I've showed you that scene. Yeah. There's the Holdo maneuver. There's Luke's treatment of sort of Star Wars iconography. You know, they kind of make him this old grump. And even though, like, he doesn't actually go through with trying to murder his nephew, I think they didn't do a careful enough job of getting us quite into Luke's head and how he approached that moment. And so they sort of let Luke down. But overall, thematically, I like what Last Jedi is doing, which is let old things die. It's sort of like, hey, let's not retroactively replay the greatest hits, you know, speaking directly to Force Awakens, which I said was too derivative. Mm-hmm. They're saying like, hey, let's let that go. You know, so they're speaking both to the characters within the story, saying like, hey, don't Rey, don't wait around for your parents. Don't wait around for these old people. Go take control of your destiny. Go do your thing. You know, Kylo Ren, his parents are Leia and Han Solo. He's saying like, hey, you know what? I don't want to live in their shadows. I want to stand on my own two feet and do my own thing, build my own legacy. I like that thematically. I think it works. And I think it works for Star Wars fandom as well, who's, you know, stuck in this cycle of like, who are Rey's parents? Is she a Kenobi? Is she a Palpatine? Is she a Skywalker? Like, let all that go and like move forward with a new story. So I think it's telling an important thing. You know, I think Rian Johnson also shot this movie beautifully. It works. And then you end up at Rise of Skywalker, CP, which is a mess, both in basic writing and thematically sort of being the capper conclusion to now 9 Star Wars films. I don't think it culminates properly. They do so many things with like Palpatine has returned. Somehow Palpatine has returned. Just magically he's back. He ends up becoming the bad guy, but it feels out of place. They have moments in this movie that characters fall into quicksand only to be dumped out on the other side exactly where they need to be. Rey has clues that she uses. You know, it's a dagger that has like a specific outline of a spot, but like to have that work, you'd have to be standing in exactly the right spot, and she doesn't mm-hmm. know that.
Yeah, but she
happens to be right there. There's just a bunch of stuff like this that sort of doesn't work. On some level, it does kind of work. Like Disney does a decent job of at least completing it. They do see it through to the end, and whether you love it or hate it, it's done. They did it. I know Rise of Skywalker in particular is, it's a shame that it's so poorly looked upon, as having watched all 9 episodes in order, knowing that the final episode, the 9th movie, is the worst one, feels like you're going out with like a firecracker. You know, it's like kind of a bummer in that way, because you would love essentially the inverse of that is like Avengers Infinity War and Endgame, where it's truly a culmination of 10 years of storytelling. They're paying out all these moments that have been building over time. And it feels like this tentpole moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't think Rise of Skywalker is able to achieve that level of success for a final sort of confrontation, but they do their best and they try to get it done. So. Sorry, I've been talking a lot, but I know you haven't seen those movies, and I have
nothing to contribute other than the fact that they suck.
Yeah, right.
So, I mean, for you, how was it getting through those final 3 movies? Because I was beat after Return of the Jedi. I went, I got a cup of coffee, and I was like, I am going home and passing out. And that's what I did. So I don't know how you managed to sit through an extra 6 hours of movie watching after I left.
I will say, I think a lot of it just has to do with your internal clock. I did not fall asleep for the entire 24 hours, but I feel like just naturally our bodies are sort of awake.
At that time when you're getting like now, into the sequel trilogy.
Yeah, the sequel trilogy is starting around noon on May the 4th. You know, you're just a little bit more awake. I think it's the doldrums of like 3 to 7 where you're like
watching A New Hope that you're like, wow, this is hard.
Yeah, like I'm keeping my eyes open, but it's just my body being like, just go to sleep. It's not that I'm bored or anything. Mm-hmm. And then vice versa, where, you know, ordinarily it might be like, oh, you know, I'm not quite as interested. I'm awake. Like, you know, I want to watch it. So
interesting. What was the drop off like between Return of the Jedi and The Force Awakens?
A lot. I would say there was definitely less than 50% of the total people that started. I don't know if it was as high as like only 10% left or low as 10% left, but definitely a drop off. I will say though, that thankfully, you know, the people that did stick around, the energy was still good. You could tell that they enjoyed the sequel trilogy. And so it wasn't just a bunch of people that hung out and are just shitting on them.
Yeah.
Which was good, because I think, you know, well, if that was the case,
it really hard if you're like, oh man, like not even the people here are having a good time and they're making this into a joke. At least everybody there was, this is still about Star Wars and celebrating Star Wars.
Yeah. And then there is, you know, a sort of importance to the sequel trilogy beyond just its place in the Skywalker saga. But these are the characters that Disney's sort of invested in, you know, whether it's Rey getting her own movie in the future, whether it's the land and the characters that they have when you go to the theme parks. Disney has incorporated elements from this into the Star Wars experience that we all get, you know, action figures, merchandise, all of that. So they are sort of celebrated across the Star Wars experience with Disney's ownership. So the movies themselves are still somewhat important to how you experience Star Wars, if you're going to really, you know, dive into the experiences that Disney's creating.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is cool. So I think they're still worth viewing. I still consider them part of the Skywalker saga with their flaws and all. And yeah, it was fun. I don't know about UCP, but that actually does it for most of our conversation. I was going to ask you, having seen, we'll just look at the first six.
Yes.
Just by theater experience, so not necessarily which one was outright your favorite, which movie did you enjoy? You want to rank like maybe your top three? You know, which ones did you enjoy the most watching?
That's a good question. I mean, I was most excited to see Empire Strikes Back, but as we already mentioned, by the time we got to Empire Strikes Back, I was looking around. You were like the only other person I saw awake for most of it, dude. I was obviously, so I'm going to rank number three. Obviously, it was great getting to see A New Hope. I know you were incredibly pumped about it, but I actually was surprised. I had a ton of fun watching Attack of the Clones and The Phantom Menace, which I was not expecting it to be. And I think it's just, we got there, people were pumped. They had their lightsabers. They were in costume. There was this amazing energy where people were just glad to see Star Wars. There was a kid who literally called his mom as we were walking in the theater. And he's like, "Mom, I left my lightsaber. I need you to bring it, because everybody here has a lightsaber." Like,
yeah,
people were just into it, man. And that was, it was fun to be a part of that.
Yeah, it was infectious energy.
It was like, why did you used to go to a Marvel movie opening night? Because everybody else was excited to be there and be a part of it.
Yeah, I'm kind of agreeing with you. I think my favorites, I thought it would hands down be number one, A New Hope, but I'll probably put that at number three. I enjoyed A New Hope. But number two was honestly, and Ivor will hate this, but it's probably The Phantom Menace. And that's because everybody, the energy in the theater when the whole thing kicked off was just so high. So experience wise, I really enjoyed that. And then number one was probably Revenge of the Sith. Like, it wasn't an energy thing. It was just that this is only the third movie that we're at, and the culmination of like execute Order 66,
yep.
Anakin's fall, everything. I was just so in to the end of that movie. It was dramatic. It was action packed. It was everything you want out of Star Wars.
Yeah.
And to see it on the big screen again was just such a delight. So I know we have tons of other feelings about all this, you know, Star Wars stuff. And I'm sure one day on this podcast, we'll get a chance to sort of deconstruct each movie and talk in depth about it. We can't get into everything on this episode, but I hope all of our listeners, you enjoyed hearing us talk about watching movies for 24 hours. And CP, just wanted to thank you for taking as many photos as you did and sharing all 70,000 of them.
Well, dude, it was a lot of fun. So I'm glad we got to do it. And, you know, in 20 years when they do a Skywalker Saga marathon again, I hope we can continue.
Yeah. And if they do another 24-hour marathon, I'm down.
All right. Good to know.
To all of our listeners, be sure to continue the conversations with us through comments, direct messages, text messages, whatever. So you can follow the show at Film Comp Podcast on social media, and you can also find a feed of all of our previous episodes at filmmakers.compass.com. I want to thank all of you guys for tuning in and for all of your comments regarding this content. We love hearing from you guys, and we're always down to talk Star Wars. So if you want to reach out to me directly, you can find me at Big Kid D-Man. And CP?
You can find me at IndyCal5. Obviously, we said a lot of really controversial stuff this last episode, so let us know your thoughts. But until then, keep watching movies. Check out that, any of the 9 Star Wars movies and leave your thoughts here. And we will see you back here next week.